From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. A federal appeals court says former Black Panther Mumia Abu-Jamal deserves a new penalty hearing. The Florida legislator says it's sorry for slavery, and could a 1968 slaying be tied to the recent murder of journalist Chauncey Bailey? That's our lineup for today's Reporters Roundtable. With us, Mark Caputo, a reporter for the Miami Herald, Bob Butler, an independent journalist and the president of the Bay Area Black Journalist Association, and radio host Cynthia Pryor Hardy, who's talked show On Point with Cynthia airs from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, folks.
How are you?
So let's start out with Mumia. Former Black Panther and radio reporter Mumia Abu-Jamal has been on death row for 26 years. In 1981, he was convicted and sent to Pennsylvania's death row for the killing of a white policeman. He has always maintained his innocence, and there are groups of dedicated activists trying to secure his release. They say the prosecution used unreliable witnesses and a predominantly white jury to secure his conviction. On the other hand, Abu-Jamal has been the subject of several books that call his defense a sham, including one called Cop Killer. Now, Abu-Jamal and his lawyer have been fighting for a new trial. Yesterday, a U.S. federal appeals court upheld the murder conviction but said Abu-Jamal deserves a new penalty hearing. His death sentence could be reviewed by a lower court. So, Cynthia, what do you think about this? This case has been going through the court for years. And do you think that this marks a turning point where advocates for his freedom have won a victory, or is this just the process unfolding?
Well, I think that, you're right, it does depend on what side you sit on, but certainly his advocates feel as if they've won a victory because it appears that his life, will be saved. I think that, though, as people look at this court system and the history of our court system and our justice system throughout the years, there's a lot of room for people to feel as if he didn't get a fair shake. And based on that, when it comes to saving someone's life or sending them to death, then I think that is what causes people pause. I do think, though, when you look at the time frame of everything, particularly in 1981 and the assertions, of course, that the jury had flawed instructions, based on that, that's enough to at least cause you to stop, reconsider, and do the fair thing.
Bob, his lawyer argued in court that prosecutors deliberately took blacks off the jury. There were 10 whites, 2 blacks that served on the jury. And why do you think the court decided to give him a penalty hearing, which basically doesn't deal with his guilt or innocence, but just deals with what he should be serving for?
It sounds like the court's just trying to cover all its bases, to cover itself, because I mean, if there's any kind of impropriety, it could be overturned on appeal, although there have been many appeals in this case. It sounds like the court just said, look, okay, here's something that we can't definitively say things were right, so let's just go back and just see whether he should be put to death or spend his life in the rest of his life in prison. And, if you're a Jamal supporter, that's not going to really be acceptable because you want him to get out. That doesn't seem like it's going to happen.
In your opinion, and Mark, I'm going to get to you in a second, but Bob, in your opinion, what significance does this case have in the black community? And what I mean by that is, there are plenty of people within the ranks of the African-American communities around America who say, well, yeah, I think he did it. And then other folks who say he didn't do it. And other folks who say, well, maybe he did, but it wasn't proven. Do you have a sense of how public opinion is flowing, particularly among African-Americans?
Well, this is similar to the O.J. case, when you have a guy who all the evidence seemed to indicate that he did it. People thought he did it, but it broke down on racial lines. If you were a black person, you think, well, maybe he did it, but you know what? There's been plenty of white folks who've gotten away with stuff like this, and this is one for our side. And whites think just the opposite, that the guy was convicted. He should have been convicted. He should have been, put in prison. In a case like Jamal, it's kind of the same thing. A lot of people just don't know, but we know plenty of people of color who have been put in prison, because of sketchy evidence. It seems like, the burden of proof is less if you're a person of color to be convicted than it is if you're not a person of color.
Mark, when you think about this case, you have the wife of the slain policeman who actually says this is a victory because Abu-Jamal will at least be in prison for the rest of his life. Is the flavor for the death penalty maybe abating a bit in this country, even among people who are victims' rights supporters?
Yeah, well, I can only talk for Florida, and you know, poll after poll, and the time this was put for a vote a few years ago, not here. There is a general love of the death penalty in Florida. We're a real lock 'em up state. We're about to have 100,000 people incarcerated in state prison soon. When I did the story recently, the other day, about the Florida legislature apologizing for its quote shameful role in propagating slavery, I noted that 16% of the state's total population is African American or black. 50.2% of the state's prison population is black. No one's able to quite answer the question as to why. Obviously, you know, there are different theories depending on where you stand in the law enforcement or, you know, racial community. And then, you know, some of the interesting comments that some of the other guests had made, we have a case here in the legislature that's pending. A guy is to get $1.2 million for spending 24 years in prison for two rapes he didn't commit. A black guy, his name is Alan Krotzer. And indeed, it seems here that if you're black, despite the fact that the last slave codes were obliterated from our state's constitution and laws in 1868, it seems like the justice system is tilted against you, and you do find these racial divisions in a variety of cases. Now, the Mumia case hasn't really, you know, set in here in Florida, but we have quite a good number of cases of racial disparities, and it doesn't seem like it's anything that's going to go away anytime soon.
Let's dig in a little bit on the Florida apology. The legislature said that it expresses its profound regret for Florida's role in sanctioning and perpetuating involuntary servitude among generations of African slaves. That's a pretty broad apology, and there have been other states that have done it. But was this an easy get, or was this highly controversial within the ranks of people who made the decision?
Well, it was done with great political skill. The Senate president, who's white, his name is Ken Pruitt, he knew that this would engender some sort of controversy, so he made sure to steer a very fine course by having this resolution voted on by voice vote, not by board vote. And the reason is that, you know, we have essentially gerrymandered representative and senatorial districts here where you're going to have a lot of, you know, white Republican voters packed into certain members' districts and a lot of, you know, black Democratic voters and others. And there does tend to be a difference of perception when it comes to acts like this. So some of those senators who might have been less inclined to vote yay didn't necessarily get put on the boards to vote yay or nay, and it made it pass much more easily. The former House clerk read a fairly detailed and rather shocking history of the legislature's role in passing laws to incarcerate and punish people for essentially being black. You know, there were, and he read, if I can, I thought this was remarkable, a letter from one of the first governors of Florida, not the first, Richard Keith Call, who tried to explain to a northerner why we should keep slavery, and he described blacks this way. Here was an animal in the form of a man possessing the greatest physical power and the greatest capacity for labor and endurance, without one principle of his nature, one faculty of mind or feeling of heart, without spirit or pride of character, to enable him to regard slavery as a degradation, a wild barbarian to be tamed and civilized by the discipline of slavery. Some senators actually cried when they heard this. But the real sad thing is, you know, we have online anonymous comments that can be posted to stories, and the, you know, kind of the racial hatred that is spewed out from this. You know, we're constantly having to delete these things, and they keep popping back up. It's kind of shocking.
Well, you know, we have another topic that we want to turn to before we wrap up, so I'm going to actually move on. I'm sure that both of you wanted to comment on that. But, Bob, you've been investigating a story in Oakland, California, about reporter Chauncey Bailey. He was gunned down while investigating the finances of a group that ran Oakland's Your Black Muslim Bakery. Now you found out that Santa Barbara police have reopened the investigation into a 40-year-old double homicide that might have ties to Your Muslim Bakery. You're with the Chauncey Bailey Project, which came about after the slaying. And how did you guys get onto this lead?
I wanted to do a story about the good work the bakery did. It's been an institution in North and West Oakland since 1970, say. And right now, all the stories that we're writing are really negative stories about all the crime that's taken place there over the last two or three years since Dr. Yusuf Bey died in 2003. And so I heard it had started down in Santa Barbara, so I went down there to try to get confirmation that, yes, it did, try to go by the site, talk to people that knew about it. And I was talking to a woman about it. She said, oh, yeah, I remember that. It started here. It was here for a while, but there were some problems. And I said, problems? What kind of problems? She goes, oh, well, there was the double murder. And I'm like, what?
You're like, oh, yeah.
And I had no idea about this. And so I began digging in, and I went to the library and went down to the microfiche room and found some old stories that talked about it. And one of the things that struck me was that it turned out that the guy who was killed, his name was Wendell Scott, had written a letter to Elijah Muhammad complaining about his minister. And that letter got back to the minister, apparently, and the minister's name was Billy Stevens. Billy Stevens was the brother of Joseph Stevens, who became Yusuf Bey and began running the Black Muslim Bakery. So I'm like, whoa.
Yeah. So, yeah, Cynthia, I'm going to ask you, this was a case where you have this crusading African-American journalist trying to dig into life in the community. Are journalists across the country, especially African-American journalists, plugging into this?
I think so. I think African-American journalists collectively realize that our justice system is not just for everyone, and our communities continually look to us to tell them the real deal, because they recognize that oftentimes mainstream media doesn't do it. So it's really good to have African-American journalists, even African-American journalists that work for non-traditional newspapers, maybe not the mainstream newspapers, that are out there committed to actually looking for the story behind the story, the truth of the matter, because oftentimes our people won't get that. And we all have a hunch in the back of our minds that we know when something doesn't quite feel right, it doesn't quite sit right. And to uncover what he's uncovered in our community, something that has been lost for many, many years, I think gives encouragement to a number of African-American journalists out there who are digging for the truth.
Well, let me get Bob in quickly before we wrap this up. What's next for you in terms of taking a look at this?
Well, we've already heard from, we had no idea where the family of Wendell Scott was. We've heard from his family. Next, the police are going to be talking to Billy, who's now up in Oakland, and his ex-wife, Mary, who was the victim's sister, Bertie Scott's sister. So it's a very interesting situation. It's actually dangerous, and people have said, you know, be careful, and I agree.
Well, Bob, Real Investigative Journalism, thank you all so much.
Thank you, Farai.
Thank you.
Bob Butler is an independent journalist and the president of the Bay Area Black Journalists Association. He was here at NPR West. Cynthia Pryor Hardy is the host of the radio talk show On Point with Cynthia. She joined us from WLTR in Columbia, South Carolina. And Mark Caputo is a reporter for the Miami Herald. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Black people don't starve themselves, throw up, or do any of the other things that constitute an eating disorder. That's what some people think, but that's wrong. Some studies show that African Americans are just as likely as whites to struggle with eating disorders, but the professionals don't always catch the problem. We'll talk with two experts about the disorders in a moment, but first, Marna Clowney Robinson is an eating disorder survivor. She's now an advocate for people of color who struggle with the problem, and she's here now to tell us her story. Marna, thanks for coming on.
You're welcome.
So let's start when you were a teenager. Describe who you were and your relationship with food and what food meant to you and how you chose to deal with it.
Well, I guess as a teenager, I really wasn't sure who I was or where I fit in. Being that I'm from a multi-ethnic African-American family, it was real hard for me to make friends and to feel included within my community. And I used food as a way of, I would say, trying to find a place for myself to fit in as well as disappear. And when I say disappear, for me, it meant not having people see me, not having people be able to make fun of me, to pick on me, to see the flaws that I was seeing within myself.
So you, by the time you were 17, were 5'10". How much did you weigh at your lowest point?
My lowest point, I was about 112 pounds.
That's extreme. And how did your family react? Did they just say, oh, you know, you've got to eat a little bit more? Or did they recognize this was a major problem?
Within my family, I don't think they actually saw it as an eating disorder, and myself didn't really see it as an eating disorder, nor saw it as a huge problem until I got treatment. I am one out of six siblings, and we all use food as a way of coping with stresses and stressful situations that came up in our lives at the time. What I was doing was pretty much normal with my siblings. So to us, it was normal behavior. It's how we use food to deal with stress.
Now, why do you think that is? And what I mean is, you know, there's a lot of people who have eating disorders. I mean, it's you know, as you know, it's not uncommon. But do you think there was, I mean, was there a moment in time where there was a stress when you were a child that kind of brought this out, or was it just sort of a family practice? Why do you think you got caught up in it?
I think for myself, I took it really hard when my parents split and felt that my father leaving was my fault. And a lot of different circumstances that led up to him leaving was actually my fault. So around 8 or 9 years old is when I first started experimenting with controlling my food intake or getting rid of my food intake.
Now, Marna, I want to get into more details of your story, but we've also got a couple other folks with us. Becky Thompson is a professor of sociology at the Simmons College in Boston. She also wrote A Hunger So Wide and So Deep, A Multiracial View of Women's Eating Problems. And Divya Kakaya is a licensed psychologist in San Diego, California, and she's been treating eating disorders since 1985. So welcome, guys. And Becky, let me go straight to you. When you are hearing Marna talk about this, what does it call up for you from your experience?
Well, first, thanks for having me on the show. I really appreciate Marna's courage and honesty. It still takes a lot of guts to talk openly about the reasons that girls and women turn to food or away from it in order to protect themselves from a range of different traumas. So she's breaking ground in two ways, and one is to talk about her specific story, but also to really counter the notion that African-American women don't get eating problems. So I just appreciate your courage.
Thank you.
So when you think about what she was saying about feeling like somehow her family divorce was her fault, is that something, is it common for people who have eating disorders to take on the weight of situations that they didn't control and may not have even really had a hand in?
Definitely. One of the themes that I saw over and over again among the women that I interviewed for A Hunger So Wide and So Deep is that they didn't feel like they had much control over anything at all. And they often turn to food or away from it as a way of trying to take care of themselves. One of the women I interviewed, for example, remembers hearing her parents go at it and her father beating up her mother. And she would make little cookies with Ritz crackers and raisins as smiles. Raisins and smiles for me and my sister is what she would say when she was 4 years old. She was also being sexually abused at the time by a family member and also by a babysitter, and she really thought that she was at fault for all of that. So as young as 4 years old, and then by 7 years old, she had really seen food as her main companion in the world.
Divya, let's dig in a little bit into what it really means to have an eating disorder. There's different types. The main ones are anorexia and bulimia. Explain what those are, first of all, and then I want to ask you a little bit more about the distinctions.
Right. Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show. I appreciate it. And just as Becky said, I think that it just really is tremendously courageous on Mona's part to tell her story, because I think this is how we dispel a lot of the myths that we have in our community. And, you know, when we look at anorexia, you know, there is a belief out there that a person who's anorexic has stopped eating completely, and that is not the case. A drive for thinness and sort of like this obsessiveness about needing to be thinner and never feeling like a person gets thin enough. So there's that whole piece of perfectionism that you find with anorexia. And then with bulimia, what we find is that women that tend to be prone to bulimia are more normal weight or slightly overweight women. And as I was mentioning, that a lot of times with anorexia, there's that drive for thinness. And with bulimia, it's much more so about the control piece. And so, and of course with anorexia, we have the same thing too. So the underlying issues are often, you know, pretty significant with eating disorders.
When you think about some more of the distinctions around these behaviors, mm-hmm. is there, you know, just tell us what the risks are. What can you do to yourself if you pursue either thinness or vomiting as a way of controlling what you do or any of the other methods?
you know what, it's with all the years I've been treating eating disorders, the medical risks are huge and tremendous. I mean, with anorexia, clearly, you know, when a woman stops having her period and her estrogen levels drop, there's a resultant decline in bone density. And eating disorders, particularly anorexia, have the highest mortality rate of all eating disorders. And unfortunately, you know, the more assimilated a young African woman, American woman is in the mainstream dominant Caucasian culture, the more high risk she tends to be for developing anorexia or bulimia, because what she's doing then is she's internalizing the values of the dominant white culture around thinness. And so the medical pieces are what often don't get talked about in terms of the complications with eating disorders.
Well, I just want to bring folks into the conversation in case they're just tuning in. This is actually the part of the wrap-up of our series on mental health, and you're listening to NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Our guests in talking about eating disorders are Marna Clowney Robinson, who has survived an eating disorder herself, Divya Kakaya, a licensed psychologist, and Becky Thompson, who wrote A Hunger So Wide and So Deep, A Multiracial View of Women's Eating Problems. Marna, did you seek help ultimately because of medical reasons?
Yes, I did. When I first tried to get help, I went to my regular doctor because I was having a lot of chest pains, esophageal problems, and it was really hard for me to get a professional to actually take me serious. And I ended up struggling for another couple of years until I actually finally found someone who could help me.
Why do you think people, some of these professionals, didn't seem to see you as someone who needed help?
What one doctor told me was that they didn't see or recognize eating disorders in minority cultures, so he was not going to go down that road. He would test for other things. I had another doctor tell me, eat like a boy, you'll be better. And another nurse pretty much told me that it was all in my head, I was making it up, because they didn't see a lot of minority patients with eating disorders.
Becky, your book is about multiracial issues within eating disorders. Is there a lack of treatment that still affects some girls and women, and we should add men and boys?
I think one of the most painful things about talking to the women who I interviewed was how many times they didn't feel as if they were seen or heard or recognized when they tried to seek different kinds of treatment. And the only silver lining there is that they often created ingenious strategies on their own. You know, many of the women came to understand that the basis of their eating problems were from a number of different traumas, from exposure to racism or sexual abuse or physical abuse or poverty or the stress of acculturation or homophobia. And so for many of them, healing included some form of activism, working in a rape crisis hotline or at a battered women's shelter or being part of a support group or getting money to go to college so that they could finish their education. And these were strategies that were outside of the medical model, but they saw as means of empowerment. And I think what's encouraging about that is that it talks about that healing is really a communal affair, that people can't do it on their own. And even if they are ignored by the medical establishment, there are other ways that people can get help, including Overeaters Anonymous, which became a big tool for a lot of the women.
Divya, how about men? How do men fit into this picture of eating disorders?
You know, it's I think about maybe 10 years ago, one out of every 10 persons coming to treatment facilities was a male. And in the last 5 years, I would say it's one out of seven that come to us that's a male. And I truly believe that the reason why we see this increase is because men's magazines are doing something very similar to what's been done for women, women of color, men of color. It's the same. You know, I was looking at some magazines a couple of days ago and just looking at the oppression that men are starting to feel, that women have felt for the last three or four decades in terms of only one particular body size is acceptable size. And with men, too, now they're getting more and more messages that that six-pack has to be equated with sexual virility. And so even in my clinic now, I'm starting to see more and more young men and men that come forward to seek help, because actually the word is getting out there that this is not just a woman's disease, and it's not only a white woman's disease. It's a disease that affects all across all sociocultural lines and across all ethnic lines. So I think that because there's more out in the field now, that we're having it less be less of a taboo, that more men are coming forward. And the issues for men clinically are the same identical issues as they are for women, which are issues around empowerment, not having a voice. There may be, it doesn't necessarily have to have trauma, but there may be some trauma in the history, a very strong history of teasing with most eating disorders. So if somebody has a certain body size and they've been teased about that, particularly for men and boys, that's a very huge traumatic event.
Marna, Becky was saying that a lot of women of color have turned, you know, to really addressing the underlying issues and or activism. You are someone who's now involved in helping other people. What do you do? What kind of outreach do you do?
Well, what I've done is I began working with Annette out of Chicago, and I help coordinate their online support network, trying to get those who struggle with eating disorders linked into the right resources for their particular geographic location. And I also have run a couple of online support forum boards so that women, men, and teens can go on and be able to talk openly, honestly, and express their voice. Because I know for myself, it wasn't until I found my voice that the healing process could not begin for me. Because with an eating disorder, it quiets your voice so much that when you get it back, it's so empowering. So what I do is I try and help people who are, and I say people because it's men, women, and even family members help find their voice in either surviving an eating disorder or helping a loved one with an eating disorder.
Becky, very briefly, what are a couple of resources that people can turn to?
One of the most exciting programs around is called the Body Positive in San Francisco. It's an empowerment program that includes producing videos and training adult and youth leaders to help combat body hatred and early onset eating problems. And I also think that the National Black Women's Health Project has been on the case with this for really 20 years, and I want to just celebrate the work that they've been doing. And then what Marna talked about as well about finding voice. One of the women I interviewed said, I didn't have any feelings about how I felt when I ate. I didn't know that there were any feelings there because for years they were stripped away from me. So for me, a first step in the process is talking with people about how to develop an affectionate understanding for the ways that they did cope,
not from
a place of blame, but from a place of self-love.
Well, Becky, Divya, Marna, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Marna Clowney Robinson is on the board of directors of the National Association of Anorexia and Associated Disorders. She joined us from WUOM in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Divya Kakaya is a licensed psychologist in San Diego. And Becky Thompson is a professor of sociology who wrote A Hunger So Wide and So Deep. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Diddy didn't do it, but that's not what the LA Times was saying earlier this week. The newspaper has apologized for falsely implicating Sean Puffy Combs in a violent attack on the late rap star Tupac Shakur, but can saying sorry save the paper's hide? And why does filmmaker Spike Lee still have to hustle so hard to get cash for his projects? That's just some of the entertainment buzz Allison Samuels is here to help me take on. She's a national correspondent for Newsweek magazine, and she's here with me now. Hey, Allison.
Hi, how you doing?
So So let's talk about this L.A. Times story. It was about the 94 attack on Tupac, and the piece was online. It appeared in print, but the Times got a big part of the story wrong. What happened?
If Chuck Phillips, who was the writer of the story, actually got a lot of the information from reports from a guy who's definitely a con artist. And they were FBI reports, supposedly, but this guy more than likely forged them because he's in jail for fraud, which is the part that's really confusing to me, is that how the reporter didn't actually realize that and realize that this guy had a long record of being a con artist. I think that what happens a lot of times with this case, there's been so much speculation about the Tupac shooting and the murder and Biggie's murder that a lot of people have just been desperate to find out anything. And there's so many stories out there. But I think what's unfortunate is when you have a mainstream newspaper like that, not to have various sources that you have to go to, which is sort of what we have to do, what I have to do as a reporter. I have to check it three or four times with three or four different
people.
And
you have been following the Tupac, Biggie, all of that.
From the very beginning. And I one reason that it's been very hard to write about it is that it is so convoluted, complicated. There's so many players in it that it's really hard to get a straight story. And that's why I think a lot of people haven't really done this big exposé, because I don't know if the truth is out there, it's been hard to find.
Somebody's not talking.
A lot of people aren't talking.
Right. So what was Sean Combs' reaction to this whole situation? And do you think he's going to sue?
He was furious. And obviously, why wouldn't he be? I mean, it was definitely, malice. That's the defamation of character. It certainly is suggesting that he knew that Tupac was going to get beaten up, that he was sort of a part of it, that he didn't know he was going to get shot, he and Biggie. But he was aware that Tupac was going to get beaten up that day. So he and his lawyers are furious, and they're talking about suing, which they probably will do. Because, I mean, that's the kind of thing, even though there are a lot of retractions, the retractions are running, a lot of people who read the initial story, they don't always see the retractions. So the damage is already done. So I think with Puffy, because Puffy has lawsuits all the time, so I think he has no problem filing a lawsuit against the LA Times. And like I said, they did a front page apology yesterday, which was really good. But I still think the damage was already done.
Let's move on to Spike Lee. You went to an event in L.A. honoring him, and mm-hmm. he got an award, gave an acceptance speech. We'll talk about a movie he has coming up, but who were some of the people there to sing his praises?
Lawrence Fishburne, John Singleton, Savion Glover, Rosie Perez, a lot of the people from his movies over the past. Halle Berry and people like that didn't attend, even though, he made a lot of those people stars, which was really interesting in watching his career over the years, just seeing how many people you'd never heard of seen before until they were in a Spike Lee movie. But a lot of the people, obviously, some of the people were not there. Hallie just had a baby, so I think that's why she didn't attend. But, overall, it was a pretty nice showing of people.
Now, he talked about his new movie, Miracle at St. Anna, mm-hmm. based on the James McBride novel. We just had McBride on not too long ago, about black soldiers in World War II. And he talked a little bit about what it was like to try to produce that. Tell us what he was talking about.
Well, it's funny because when he got up to accept his award, in true Spike fashion, he had to, sort of have a little rant. And he talked about having a hard time raising the money to get this movie made, and how surprised he was about that, because Inside Man, his last film with Denzel, made $300 million worldwide. So, with that kind of track record, you figure, okay, my next film, I'm gonna get it made, no problem. I won't have any, issues at all. But he actually had to go overseas for funding. And so he was just sort of saying that it's always a double standard for African Americans, even when you have international box office success, which is something they say African Americans don't have. It's still another obstacle for you. It's never enough. So I think that was the part that was sort of interesting to hear him talk about. And he's talked about that over the years, obviously. But I am surprised that 20 years later in his career, it is still that same obstacle that he's fighting. And he wants to make James Brown into a movie. He's having a hard time with that. Joe Louis, it's a lot of things.
Let's touch quickly on Michael Baisden, incredibly popular black mm-hmm. radio host. He was a driving force behind the Gina 6 marches. Here he is on the line with scholar and activist Cornel West.
Old school hip hop on the Michael Baisden show. What is the next level, family? It's not about being negative, not about blaming hip hop. Welcome to the show, a man I have much admiration and respect for, Cornel West.
What you do, though, brother, is force for good in terms of sustaining dialogue in the community, though, man.
Cornel West is on the Michael Baisden show, family. And so we can shut the show down now. We can shut it down.
Extra lively, lots of deep topics, but right. He's in a bit of hot water with some of his fans. What's going on?
Well, it's more sort of the affiliates, the stations that he's sort of on, because he's been very vocal about the Obama situation, running the entire sermon of Reverend Wright, trying to make it very clear that you know, that, that people have misjudged this pastor and that you need to listen to the entire sermon to get a really full understanding. And I think he's made people nervous because he does bring up this sort of intense dialogue. He did get people sort of together for Genesis 6. And I think that when you have that kind of power, it can be a little unsettling to some people. And I think that's a struggle that he's fighting now with his affiliates, just how political he can actually be.
So is this really about white station owners not buying into something that his audience embraces?
I think that probably is the nice way of putting it, yes. I think that they're a little afraid of, you know, how political he's actually gotten and the power, because people do listen and they sort of respond to him.
So, Allison, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Allison Samuels is a national correspondent for Newsweek magazine, and she joined me here at our studios at NPR West. Who really invented rock and roll? Did it start with bluesmen deep down in the Mississippi Delta? Was it Elvis who jump-started the genre with his rockabilly flair?
Just let me hear some of that rock and roll music.
Or do the real props go to a St. Louis guitar whiz with an oil-slick pompadour and duck-walk dance moves? Maybe Chuck Berry didn't create rock and roll, but rock and roll wouldn't have been nothing without Chuck Berry.
I took my loved one over across the tracks, so she could hear my man a wailing sax. You must admit they have a rockin' band. Man, they were blowing like a hurricane. That's why I go for that rock and roll music.
Berry launched his recording career in the mid-1950s with Chess Records. The Chicago label was once home base for gospel and blues greats Etta James and Muddy Waters. Chess is where Berry laid down some of his classics, including Maybelline and Johnny B. Goode. That last title is also the name of a new 4-CD box set. It's the most comprehensive CD collection of Chuck Berry's Chess recordings. Grammy Award-winning producer Andy McKay produced the whole thing, and he's here with me now. Hey, Andy.
Hello.
So this is great. Great to have you in the studio. And let's talk a little bit about his upbringing. Chuck Berry was in St. Louis in a mostly black community. How did he get into hillbilly music to the point that he was playing it for black audiences?
Well, I think it was in the air. It's music that was most immediate on radio, especially from that area. And so he heard the latest sounds coming through the over the radio and melded it with the blues sounds that was in the neighborhood and came up with something unique.
Only 9 years and sweet as she can be.
It's a unique melding. What he came up with is much different than what was going on at the time, in black, white, or any kind of music.
And away she goes, her dad, he must be proud. Cause there's so many places young folks aren't allowed. And it must be good, cause bad things don't draw crowds.
Now, I mentioned in my introduction the Chicago record label Chess. So what was that outfit like? Why did it become a home base for so many important recording artists?
There were two Polish immigrants, Phil and Leonard Chess. They moved into the black community in Chicago and identified with the black community. And one of the artists they had was Muddy Waters. And that leads us directly to Chuck Berry, because Chuck Berry came to Chicago, looked up his hero, Muddy Waters. He told Muddy that he'd like to make a record. And he said, go see Leonard Chess. And Leonard Chess said, do you have a demo? And he said, no, but I'll be back in a week with one. He went back home, made the demo to a song called Ida Red. He came back with it. Then it said, it's a lot of fun, but this title, Ida Red, doesn't work. And they chose Maybelline. Changed the name of the song, the name of the woman, and it became one of the biggest, the fastest selling Chess record to date.
As I was motivating over the hill, I saw Maybelline in a coupe de ville. A Cadillac rolling on an open road, nothing out of run my V8-4.
You know, when you think about why the style was so viral, what was unique about the way that Berry played?
He used a unique mixture of the different kinds of music. Plus, he was the first great poet laureate of rock and roll. He tapped into the explosion of teenage years, especially.
Yeah, you were only 16, so young but yet so fine.
Yeah, Sweet Little 16 has, you know, it lays a footprint for, like, the Beach Boys.
They're really rocking in Boston and Pittsburgh, PA, deep in the heart of Texas and around the Frisco Bay.
Was this a ripple effect that carried forward into other musicians?
Absolutely. Essentially, he made the map. Buddy Holly maybe made the map for a band. Chuck Berry made he created the format, though, for rock and roll, from the lyric content to the guitar riffs to the rhythms.
All the cats wanna dance with, oh, sweet little 16.
He was the architect. That's the term that some people use.
She's got the grown-up blues, tight dresses and lipstick. She's sporting high-heel shoes.
Here's another one of Berry's songs, probably his most famous, Johnny Be Good.
Deep down in Louisiana, close to New Orleans, way back up in the woods among the evergreens, there stood a log cabin made of earth and wood, where lived a country boy named Johnny Be Good.
The amazing thing about Johnny Be Good to me is that it sounds like a folk song. It sounds like a song that came out of the generations, just honed over generations, not written by an individual. And that it is written by an individual.
He used to carry his guitar in a gunny sack, go sit beneath the tree by the railroad track.
Oh, sort of the apex, of Chuck Berry's songwriting, because it sounds so natural. Just something that anyone who the greatest songwriters of any generation would be proud of.
Go, go.
Now, if you remember the 80s film Back to the Future, Michael J. Fox does kind of a faux performance to this song, you know, miming the guitar, lip-syncing, and it brings up the whole relationship between black rock and roll, white rock and roll, imitation, stealing, all this stuff. Sometimes history is told as a one-way street. Black artists created the style, white musicians like Elvis Xeroxed it. But the real story is probably more complicated. How did the black and white musicians in early rock and roll days interact with each other and each other's sounds?
Well, they seem to be... I wasn't there. I'm not quite that
That's
old.
That's a good place to start.
I'm not quite that old.
We can just say, in research terms, given your ample experience, how did they interact?
They seemed to interact wonderfully. They seemed to love each other. They fed off each other.
How did Berry's audience reflect all that cultural mixing? I mean, in terms of white audiences, black audiences, who were his audiences?
Well, I think the audiences were very mixed. From what I've seen, it's an extremely mixed audience. They were in the South, when he played down there, like any other artist at the time, they were actually, you know, chord lines down in the sand, as well as in reality, one side black, one side white. But in the North, it was a generally, for the most part, an integrated audience and a good audience, solid audience. I was a little too young, but at the same time, you know, my neighborhood was primarily Italian Americans in New York City, and Chuck Berry was one of our heroes.
I don't run with no mob. Got myself a job. Buy me a little car. Drive my girl in the park.
Do you think that Chuck Berry gets enough credit for shaping rock and roll? That, you know, people who may be in their 20s and 30s really know enough about him?
Probably not. But at the same time, anybody who delves into the music at all for any length of time usually stumbles the Chuck pretty quick. I mean, Elvis is certainly the leading, most popular artist from the era, still. But Chuck Berry is not that far behind in so many other respects.
Well, Andy, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
I got lumps in my throat when I saw it coming down.
Andy McKay is Senior Vice President A&R at Universal Music Enterprises. He produced the new 4-CD box set, Chuck Berry, Johnny Be Good, his complete 50s chess recordings. He joined me here at our NPR West studios.
Looking like a model on the cover of a magazine. She's too cute to be a minute old.
singing. She's in the mood. No need to break it. I got a chance.
And you can check out some of Chuck Berry's classic performances on our blog, nprnewsandviews.org.